When we last left our heroes, they were locked into a terribly important discussion. Let's drop in on them again as they plot the future. Now, from the Top Dog's Kennel in beautiful downtown Burbank, it's the Terrence and Philip Show.
Well, thanks, Gary, and welcome to another episode of the Terrence and Philip Show. I'm Philip Hodgetts.
And I'm Terrence Curran.
And I thought this time we might, since it's the end of the year, do the thing that people do at the end of the year, and that's look back at the year that was, 2012, what happened?
Makes sense to me. Now, of course, if you're hearing us on this podcast, which is being recorded on the 20th,
yeah,
then that means the 21st was not the end of the world.
It's already the 21st in most of Asia and Australia, and they're reporting that they're still there. So I feel fairly confident that it's worth the effort to put into the podcast. Yet another end of the world that has not ended up the ended the world.
This is a safe one to be, to prognosticate on, because yeah. If you're wrong, you'd never know it, so
that's
who cares?
That's true. Who cares? Yeah, it's unlike almost everything else in the next show where we prognosticate on what we think might happen in 2013.
That's right.
It's much easier to look back on the history and say, well, this is what happened last year. The really serious trends that I pick out of 2011, 2012, but particularly momentum in 2012, were the affordable large sensor cameras, and not just DSLRs, but
yes.
You know, the progression. RED's really sort of broke the ground there, and then a little bit had the ground kicked out from underneath them with the DSLR trend.
Mm-hmm.
And then we've seen a response back from Canon with the C300, C100s.
Well, and of course now Blackmagic really
Blackmagic came up in the middle of NAB, and they still, you know, they're only just getting around to shipping that camera now.
Yes, but they basically came out at NAB and go, well, you know, here's this camera, and everybody looked at it and goes, hey, that's what Scarlett was supposed to be.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, not quite 3K, 2.5K, but for $3,000 and an enormously valuable package if you have use for the scopes and the other things that come.
Yeah. The software and the scopes, which, you know, if you're shooting on a set, it makes sense.
Oh, great stuff, yes. Yeah. You need that. And I love the fact that metadata is entered right there on the camera, not perhaps as comprehensively as I would like, but then I have my own specific needs for metadata.
Mr. Metadata.
Yes, yes. We actually will be revealing Lumberjack for the first time at the Hollywood Post Alliance conference in February.
Ah, so
the
you
retreat.
Did
that. You
yes, did it.
In the demo room. You can check us out. So I'd say that's been a big trend, and certainly my experience with NEX7s, the Sony's DSLRs, and the FS100 in that same family, the NEX FS100, was certainly very positive. I really do love the look from these large sensor cameras, just both as a still camera and as a video camera.
Mm-hmm.
I jokingly say that the cheapest professional video camera I've ever paid for has been also the best quality, and that's the NEX7. Even the FS100 at, you know, $5,500-ish is still...
It's crazy, isn't
it? Yeah, and of course, they've since released the camera that I really would have liked, the EA50,
mm-hmm.
which is the more traditional video form factor of a camera very like an FS100.
The problem now is because the changes are coming so fast and furious, it's like a cell phone. If you're going to buy one, you have to wait until you really absolutely need it, because buy it now in anticipation of using it 4 months from now, you're going to
the FS100 resale value went down because of the announcement of the EA50 and the announcement of the FS700,
mm-hmm.
you know. The FS100 wasn't even dry. The paint on it wasn't properly dry before they announced its replacements. But certainly for us, it worked out well for the number of shoot weeks, and of course more shoot weeks were planned.
Yeah,
we actually did much better from buying and then reselling gear than we would have had we rented.
That makes sense.
Even though it worked out, you know, you take a loss, but that's the rental on the production, so that's directly costed to the production.
I can't even imagine where there's a market in the rental business now, you know?
Well, it's got to be up at the higher end. I mean, Sony have come back out fighting at the high end with a whole bunch of big cameras that are really attracting attention. Not to forget the one that everybody seems to like in Hollywood, and that's the Alexa.
Yes, but the F65 is definitely making huge inroads. You know, that's another very preferred camera.
Yeah.
So it's kind of between those two. The 65 just hasn't been around as long as the Alexa yet to really build out the following, I guess.
Yeah.
But I guess what I'm saying as far as a rental market is, yeah, that's enough to support a couple rental places, but not like what we used to have. Because if you were doing semi, not high-end, but you know, mid-range stuff in the past, you went and rented a camera package.
Yeah.
Now you'll buy it. So there's a huge market that's gone out of the middle of this that, well,
yep, in
there
terms
it is.
Of image acquisition, we've never had higher quality for less money at every budget point, really.
Exactly.
That's probably always been the trend, but it just got to the point now where it's not a huge decision as to buy a decent camera or not. So you're going to use it professionally. You could start with a DSLR, actually under $1,000 with a decent camera. I mean, I'm really happy with the NEX7. The only place where it fails is it will tend to overheat on really long, continuous takes.
That can be a problem.
Yeah, but I mean, we're talking 12, 15 minutes in. So.
Yeah, so that's interviews.
It's interviews, yeah. One of my two cameras never actually stops. It just shows the overheat warning. The other will occasionally stop, and you just got to power it down, power it back on, and continues. If I'm always shooting two cameras, I've always got coverage. And I think one of the other trends that's matured this year too is the use of audio as a synchronizing tool between double system. The maturing of double system out.
Yes.
And again, driven by the DSLR trend, always universally lousy audio.
Right.
So you need to record audio separately. Well, traditionally that meant time code and gear.
And assistant editors syncing dailies and on and on and on. Yeah.
But yeah, starting with Pluralize and now built into Final Cut Pro 10, you know, these tools for synchronizing based on matching audio waveforms are becoming ubiquitous. I see there's a new lower-priced alternative has come into the market, the name of which eludes me. But, you know, somebody is just saying, oh, well, I can do that. I can do that cheaper than the existing player, and I'll make a fortune.
Yeah. Here we go.
I also think it was slightly unrelated, but indirectly, it's the year that the App Store really took off. Customers' preferred mode of buying Mac software.
Hmm. Well, I'm not one of those who prefers to buy it. I like having the physical copy. So Yeah, I mean,
good luck with that.
So I don't know how much of it is took off versus were forced to that point.
Well, we have tools that are available, both some of them are available in the Mac App Store and some of them are still on our website. We would much prefer it to be, say, Event Manager 10, for example, to be in the Mac App Store. We'd get better exposure, we'd probably sell more, we have less of a support issue.
Right.
But because of the nature of the way the App Store is set up, that particular app failed when we submitted it and failed on appeal. And although, you know, general agreement was that it was a useful tool, it doesn't meet the App Store requirements of not stomping on another app's folders. And the number of people who have said, when is Event Manager 10 going to be in the App Store? I'd really like to buy it in the App Store. I prefer to buy it in the App Store. I've heard that enough this year to realize that that is given the sanction by Apple to be, you know, stuff that's not problematic, that stuff that's not going to be damaging your computer. And people like that imprimatur of a known source.
The validation.
The validation, yeah.
Okay.
So that's a side trend. It's really not completely related to our industry.
No, not really. I agree with you on the cameras. That's the biggest change, because prior to this last year, if I were going to shoot some little project, I would have thought about, you know, renting a camera package. And this year, I would just think of buying it. I can't even imagine. You know, unless you need to get high-end camera package or, you know, the lenses, let's say, well, I wouldn't rent, I'd buy.
Yeah.
Because in a week shooting, you paid for the camera.
Yeah, or buy the camera and rent the lenses.
Yeah, exactly. Which is, you know, well, you can do that with the Blackmagic. You buy that and rent the lenses. So.
And I think most people buy the Red cameras and rent the lenses.
Yeah.
Because they're actually a lot more valuable and have a longer lifespan, really. I see people looking back at vintage, you know, 60s and 40s glass, putting on modern cameras and finding it's working just nicely. Thank you.
Yeah, absolutely, because it's a very simple mechanical concept, whereas all the cameras are all electronic now, so that's constantly evolving.
Another trend, another change that I think I am happy to see is that people are talking about metadata as actually something they want to care about. Finally.
Your metadata.
See, I knew if I kept going on about this long enough.
It's going on your tombstone, you know.
I never metadata I didn't like.
It will say, if you want to know more about Philip, check out his metadata.
Exactly. Exactly, yeah. So we're seeing cameras and seeing tools that put the metadata acquisition up right up front as early in the process as it can be. And
which is important, because that makes it easier to deal with later.
Yeah, until we get to the point where more and more metadata can be derived by the actual technology itself, you know, the secret to getting metadata in is enter it earlier and easier. And, of course, that's what we're on about with Lumberjack. The whole idea is to make it earlier and easier. And Adobe are doing the same thing with Prelude, and I'm pretty sure they've got some exciting things coming up that they'll talk about in due course with the idea of entering metadata early and easily.
Mm-hmm.
But at the moment, we're not allowed to talk about those things. They are those things we're not talking about are going to be fabulous, though.
Yes. That's what I always loved when you get the Apple guys doing, like, the Final Cut demos when they'd release, you know, a new version at an editor's lounge. And you'd be like, well, what about, does it, you know, is it going to do this or what about this, et cetera? You ask them a question and they just they wouldn't say anything, but they'd shake their head or, well, what do you think? While they're nodding their
heads. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. It's all about plausible deniability.
That's exactly. I didn't say that it was going
to
do that.
Or the other way they often used to do it at least was, yes, we've definitely heard that from a lot of customers.
Yeah. Hint, hint.
I think another trend that I like is that the fact you can't buy a bad tool. The way the competition has gone and the price competition has gone is it's really impossible in the market to go out and buy a completely bad tool.
Oh, I see what you're saying. Yeah, like a non-functioning tool, you mean?
Well, something that
won't do the job.
We used to have some lesser NLEs that wouldn't have done a professional job, that mm-hmm. couldn't do it. There was compromises in every affordable video camera.
Yeah.
There are compromises in a DSLR, but not in...
Yeah, well, I was just going to say.
But then the FS100, there is the completely artificial limit being placed in by the manufacturer. The limitation is that it's recording to a compromised codec relative to what you'd like for maximum post-production manipulation.
That's
AVCHD.
That's one part. And another part is, with the DSLRs at any rate, the inability to have a decent screen while you're shooting to check focus, which means, you know, and with a limited depth of field, everything's out of focus.
You know. The NEX7's got a HDMI output, and I've got a little HD monitor from Small HD that I've decided to keep and not sell.
Mm-hmm.
So, yes, I've got a nice big screen to check my focus with.
So now you have the extra monitor.
Yeah, I know. I know.
Pretty soon you're going, I don't have a video.
Well, actually, what I do with the NEX7 most of the time is it has a great function. It's like autofocus with manual override.
Mm-hmm.
Just to pop up to see the area of interest,
mm-hmm.
focus that, and then it'll pop back to the full view for final composition before you release the shutter.
Okay.
I do have that ability to get a really sharp and clean focus. That's just on one camera, though. It's a camera feature, not a universal feature. And even on some of the screen sizes for the FS100 comes with a built-in screen, but it's not big enough without focus assist of some sort to accurately check focus.
The separate audio is the second problem. Well, let's say third, because you said the compression.
Yes, that's true.
Yeah. So you've got three strikes right there. Form factor for shooting sucks,
yeah.
So there's four. So really, at this point, the DSLR is still a great compromise for the photographer who needs to get video footage. But because the other cameras have come down in cost to within the range, there's no point in buying a DSLR anymore to shoot.
No, largely. I mean, I like the DSLR because I like to shoot stills as well.
Okay.
So that works very well for me.
Swap lenses.
And, of course, when you bring it all into, in my case, Final Cut 10, it's all sorted by file time, creation date anyway, because the files from both NEX7s and FS100s have the same format that starts with the date and time.
That's the file name.
So, and it just sorts automatically into the right. This one was shot at the same time as this one is overlapping that one. So my synchronizing of events between cameras is pretty cool. And that works whether they're shooting consecutively or concurrently.
That's convenient.
Yeah, shooting an FS100 along with an NEX7. But,
mm-hmm.
but the audio it's an issue.
It is. And even though you've got, you know, Pluralize, et cetera, or Final Cut 10 to synchronize it, okay. But what I keep hearing over and over again is audio, the camera audio being a couple frames out of sync to start with. So even though you're syncing up, you know, you're syncing up your good audio, you're syncing it up to audio that's out of sync. So I guess it's not audio is not prioritized on the DSLRs. Certainly with the Canons, this is a pretty common problem.
I have not noticed that any sort of loss of sync with the NEX7. But
well, that's okay. But yeah, like I say, with the Canons, it's pretty common a couple frames off.
Oh, well, that's not good.
No.
but that happens also with the professional sync and link tools. So, I mean, if you've got matching time code, even that can still be a frame off.
Yeah, that's true.
That's one of the feature requests we've just added to Sync and Link 10 that we had in Sync and Link Classic was that a frame offset. So if you know it's a frame out one way or the other, you can just compensate that during the synchronizing process.
Which, you know, that's fine, but it's a pain in the ass if you've got, you know...
Hundreds of hours.
Yeah, it's a pain in the ass if you've got hundreds of hours of footage one way or the other. It's a bigger pain in the ass if you're not working with the professional tools that can say, all right, this is off by one frame. You know, if you're synchronizing by audio and the audio that you're synchronizing it to and the camera is off, then there's not much to do but break it apart, slip it a couple of frames, join it back up again, or however you would do that in whichever NLE you're working with. Exactly. It's a problem.
It is a problem. Other trends. I think, obviously, Adobe's really trying hard to make Premiere the competition.
Yes.
Well, obviously, when Final Cut 10 came out, they go, oh, we've got a window of opportunity, and they really cranked it up. We know, because they were talking to us at the time. But I'm not seeing the traction in my universe. It doesn't mean it's not happening out there, but I'm not seeing it here in, you know, the so-called Hollywood broadcast television universe. It's still just not happening.
No, by and large, that universe is still Media Composer and entering the Final Cut 7.
So yeah, exactly. We're still dealing with 7. I mean, so many Final Cut 7 projects.
We've talked about this before, but I think it's my strong-held belief that the majority of people are working with Final Cut 7 or 6 are still working with Final Cut Pro 7 or 6.
Yeah, they are, exactly.
They haven't moved anywhere. There was an immediate move of a particular group here in Hollywood that moved straight back to Media Composer. And
well, they have to spend X amount every year and upgrades and whatnot, so there was nothing else for them to buy at that point other than to go to Media Composer.
Yeah, but most people don't have to do that. Most people don't have to make a change right now. Some very, very tiny group of experimental people have gone to Final Cut 10. It's probably not much beyond the stories that Apple share with us in actual penetration.
Yeah. I think a lot of it is for the people using Final Cut 7 now. Going forward, it's going to be as codecs aren't supported, you know, new codecs.
Yeah, there'll that's be something where comes up.
They're going to be forced to make a choice somewhere.
Or ultimately, there will be a version of the operating system that doesn't include all of the classic QuickTime architecture.
That just made me think of, here's another trend is, and there's a thread on this on the Final Cut list right now, that it's very common now for people to have all the NLEs on the one system.
Yeah.
Because all the NLEs now support third-party hardware, and all the NLEs can coexist on the same system. So you can have, if you've got a Mac computer, you can be sitting there with Media Composer, Premiere, and Final Cut 7 and Final Cut 10 all running on the same system. Not necessarily all at once, because unless you got a ton of RAM, but you can certainly have all of them on the one system sharing the same Kona card or Blackmagic card.
Yeah, I believe the Matrox is still waiting for a unified
driver. Yeah, Matrox is a problem, apparently. Yeah, it's a different driver for every
one, which would mean different partitions for each one. But I think in that same thread, somebody reported that Matrox have just released or about to release a unified driver. So that would be much better.
Can't say I'm a big Matrox fan, so I wouldn't really.
No, but they make some nice hardware that fills a need. Their MX-02, for example, had the only combination of inputs and outputs that could stay wired up that Les Perkins needed.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing at all in either of the other two companies' range would allow an S-Video and a component analog to be connected at the same time because they're the same connectors.
Right.
You know,
swapping them all the time.
Bring a whole bunch of things. Another trend is the one that I'm least happy about, the downward price pressure on software.
Oh, yeah.
In the days when we do a $5 piece of software and people say, is there a free alternative?
Right.
Or a $10 piece of software, is there a free alternative? It's like, oh, I'm sorry, people. At least pay for your software and your tools what your coffee costs.
When somebody's complaining about that, it's really shameful. You guys don't even make a piece of software that can't save you, say, 20 minutes on a job.
Yeah.
What's 20 minutes of your time worth?
You know? If it's not worth $5 or...
Then you maybe should be looking for a different profession.
I hear plumbing pays well.
Ooh. Oh, no. Greg Husson, I'm talking to him this morning, and he's at home because his sewer trouble and the plumber's there, and he goes... Yeah, he says the sewer pipe shot out of sewage all over the plumber's face, and he said, well, there's another alternate career out the door.
Yeah, I think that would do it for me, too.
Yeah.
I do think clean is one of my priorities.
Yeah, that's right. Bad as post can be, it's never that bad.
No, dealing with...
Though we are kind of dealing with the same concept all the time, polishing a turd.
Often, yeah. Some of my best editing work is polishing a turd and making it into something that was barely acceptable. It's like, well, nobody's seeing that on my reel, but it's some of my best, cleverest work.
Yes, exactly. which is why I don't like demo reels.
Yeah,
you
know? It's really hard to tell from a demo reel in any sort of a useful amount of time.
You could take crap and do a great job and turn out something that's decent. Or somebody else could get gold where they hardly had to do anything and create a fantastic product, and their demo reel is going to look better. But the other editor's better.
I think part of the smarts of working in an industry is knowing what it is that you are good at,
mm-hmm.
and not trying to go into areas and pretend knowledge that you're not good at, because I see way too much of that.
Well, and that's one of the problems with the whole NLE concept that gave us, you know, all the tools in one box, and so now you're supposed to know all of that. It's like, okay, could I cut and mix audio? Yeah. Am I going to be as good as somebody who does it all day long every day in Pro Tools? No. You know, do I want to be? No. And I don't expect them to be any good at color correcting either. So, no. You know, it's like pick a spot. So,
and I don't expect color correctors to necessarily be great storytellers.
Exactly.
Maybe there are. I'm sure there are.
Yeah, it kind of depends, I guess, on the background. I mean, because I came from editing and ended up in doing color correction. I've been doing it so long that I've gotten good at both, but I'm rusty in the storytelling side. Yeah. It would take me longer now to edit a story together than it would have 10 years ago. I'll still get the same end result, but it's just I'm not doing that every day. So. Yeah.
They seem to be the main trends, don't they?
Yeah. Well, I will say that it's certainly out here. In LA, it seems like the market has picked up in the last year. After, obviously, 2008, everything went to hell.
Yep.
And it feels like it's getting back. I can't say getting back. It's never going to get back to where we were back in 2007. But it does feel like at least it's stabilized. That's been the weird part. It's sort of been an up and down
really
rocky ride.
There's not really anybody else for Deluxe or Technicolor to buy, is there?
No. Well, I mean, we're not for sale, so. No, I have. I've actually had people ask about that, you know. So would you? That's funny. All the other editors I know, you know, it seems like everybody's kind of working now.
Good.
You know, yes. Whereas even last year, I still knew a lot of people who were, if they were working, it was spotty. So now it feels more.
There's still some softness. I know a couple. I mean, I'm really down to just two consulting clients these days by choice.
Mm-hmm.
Occasional person I'll help out because they're in a bind. But largely, well, one of them has been working heavily on Cinerama all year.
Oh, yeah. So it's, I know who that is.
Well, it's Dave Strohmeyer. You wouldn't have to look very far to work out Dave has been heavily involved in the Cinerama. And the other one is still finding it a little bit soft. But that's largely because his business was revolving around extras for DVDs releases.
Right.
And
that's a tough, yeah.
And that market is pretty much gone. You know, the DVD releases are released. Mm-hmm. Of libraries, and the preparation is being done for streaming.
I know some of the companies that were almost dead and are now doing it. They're back to not 2007, but they are back to doing it because the Blu-rays and stuff, I guess, are still selling. It's starting to come back a bit for some reason. The new movies have never stopped doing that. It's just that it's consolidated to a couple major companies who get all that work. It was the library stuff. You know, when the studios start going back and remastering the libraries and coming up to Blu-ray, then it's like, okay. And we're getting them, you know.
I don't think there'll be quite the move to Blu-ray that there was to DVD. I don't think we're going to go the whole library back onto Blu-ray.
If that's the only way you get extras, though, it's worth it.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? That, to me, anyways, if that forces them to make the extras, that's a downside to just having the actual movie available is we lost it. That was a little sweet spot because we didn't have that before. You know, 15, 20 years ago, you didn't have any of that. So it kind of started with the Laserdiscs.
Yeah.
That was the value added, and then it just grew from there. And it's nice having that, especially the behind-the-scenes stuff when you can really see that's how they did that.
Oh, yeah, I love the behind-the-scenes stuff. I love VFX breakdowns that show the camera reel and then the actual what happened.
Yes, like, oh my God. Step-by-step adding layers.
They're some of my fun things. I've said it before, and I'm probably saying it again, that if I came back and I had a career to do over again, I definitely think I'd be interested in looking at visual effects.
But you'd either have to work at ILM or move to Asia.
And it doesn't look like it's a particularly lucrative career looking forward for
the
practitioners. No.
No, it's pretty rough right now,
Speaking about, like, not in direct relation to this topic, but I was reading this morning that a movie for Netflix gets encoded 100 times.
Wow. That movie has by the time it gets to Netflix, or Netflix encodes
Netflix
it?
Netflix encodes it.
100 variations.
I haven't looked at the content of the article as to whether that's variations or that's iterations to get it right, but I suspect it's probably a combination of both.
That'd be interesting.
Yeah,
well, you know, last year at the HPA event, there was a guy from Disney, and he was basically presenting a case for what he needed. But he was talking about, you know, he said, just take any feature. And he said, you know, so here's your, you know, we have the master of the feature. Now we have to have, you know, and he starts going through the different versions. You know, you've got to have the various languages, obviously. And then there's different cuts. There's the different aspect ratios. There's the different sizes. There's the different frame rates. Okay, so now already, you know, he was up to like 30 or 40 versions of just the first movie. Now you start getting into the, you know, the airplane version and, you know, Saudi Arabia. And it just got exponential, and it was up into like, you know, they can end up with like 30,000 versions of masters of a movie. And he goes, he wants a system where he can sit there and go on a screen, punch in, I want this movie with this kind of a cut, these things removed, and this aspect ratio, and this audio configuration, and then bam, on the back end, it spits out a file. That's what he wants, which is, you know, somebody's obviously going to figure out how to do that.
It's all doable with metadata.
Right, yes, and, exactly, you know, with metadata.
You need some smart algorithms, because when you change language, you change durations of certain shots, so there's going to have to be a fair bit of metadata analyzed.
It's not going to be easy to build, but once that workflow's in place,
Yeah.
Of course, that means that folks like us who are prepping the movies, we're going to have more work on the front end.
One of the things I did last year was go to an Avid professional briefing, and they were talking about how Avid Professional Services had smoothed out workflow and automated a lot of workflow of Discovery, where even Discovery, once they finished a program, had something, I think, like 34 different iterations that they needed to go through for different languages, different regions, different aspect ratios, all of that. And they had been sitting down with editors in a Media Composer Bay doing all that manually. They had worked out, I forget the technologies and everything, but they had actually basically pulled it down to one button derivation of all of the outputs.
That's cool.
Yeah.
Yeah, I know for us on the delivery side, it used to be when we delivered Discovery shows, you know, we were delivering three or four masters and a D88 with all the audio. And now it's one master tape, the SR tape, with the show, Texas Elements at the end, and all the audio on there, the various audio configurations that are laid into tracks. And then they digitize it in, and obviously goes through their automated process, so whatever format needs to go wherever, it's just done there.
Yeah.
Which is fine by me. Because when you're doing multiple versions of masters, now you've got to QC all of those. This way is one tape to QC.
Well, we've heard Mark Radonis talk about their deliverables, how they've changed from a tape or two variations to now there's the back channel, there's the web material that's got to be produced for it, there's the second show, and all of these other variations out of the same source material that have to be delivered. So it's become immensely more complex, which apparently is another trend.
Yes, there you go.
More complex delivery requirements as the world gets more complex.
Yeah. Well, and I can say that I think we trended away, finally, from 3D, sort of.
I do feel that there's
special venues, and that's about it at this point, I think.
Yeah, now we've got to go through high frame rate and 4K.
Well, high frame rate, certainly, and that's tied to the 3D. We'll see. I mean, of course, The Hobbit made a ton of money on the opening weekend. So like Avatar, they're going to go, I know.
It was going to make a ton of money regardless if it was in 18 frames.
But you know how this goes.
Black and white. Yeah.
Now we're going to hear, see, this proves that people want to see it 48-frame 3D. No, it proves they want to see The Hobbit. Titanic was not in 3D or high frame rate, and yet it was, you know, the blockbuster. But when the same director makes Avatar, then all of a sudden it's the technical end, not his skill as a director.
Yeah, well, see, that's a trend I'd like to see, is away from the technology to the skills and focus on that, because we still focus way too much on, what tools are you using? Tell me about the glass. Tell me about the camera.
Yes.
You know, what's the format? What's the recording format? How many bits? How much?
If I had to assign a reason for that, it's because there's nobody monetarily invested in convincing you that, you know, it's all about the director, but there's lots of companies monetarily invested in convincing you it's about the gear.
Yep, that's probably true.
And that's why 4K is going to get shoved down our throats.
Yep.
When we bought all the 4K gear and everybody has all the 4K stuff and it's still streaming down the same size bandwidth pipe as we've got now, then they're going to go, it's 8K.
Yeah.
So then we'll buy all the crap again and we'll still be watching it all squeezed down to the same size coming down the same pipe. Nobody's talking about quadrupling the size of the pipe to the house.
You can do 4K on YouTube right now.
That's right. You can do 8K.
Would you want to do that? I don't think so.
I'm not calling it a trend. I'm calling it like 3D. I think, you know, yeah, there's going to be some back push, you know, back channel pushing. Oh, this is, you got to have 4K. But then Sense is going to come in when people start going, wait a minute, you know, I got to have, you know, four times as much storage. I got to have four times the bandwidth just to work with this footage, you know.
When we were putting together Solar Odyssey, I was looking to see if I could, you know, get sponsorship for a camera, maybe. And I thought, well, Canon's doing pretty well with the C300. I don't think they need to push it out to me, and Sony's doing fine with their FS100, barely keep up supply. Mm-hmm. But JVC's got that 4K camera that I haven't seen any success stories with, you know. Yeah. That'd be a good place to pitch. But yeah, first I should do a little research and look at the workflow and said,
yeah,
I'd rather pay for a camera than that.
Yeah.
Because the
yeah
workflow is forever. The saving is once off, but the workflow is forever.
Yeah.
So I guess that will get better, but at the moment trying to fit 4x HD definition into current workflows, mm-hmm, it's usually done as 4x HD.
But yeah.
That's a lousy workflow.
It was like the thing with the Red camera. When it initially came out, yeah, it was great quality for ridiculously cheaper, and so we were willing to put up with the pain in the ass post-workflow. But, you know, once you get Alexa out there and now the F65, et cetera, all these other options that don't have that pain in the ass factor on the back end, Red's not so appealing anymore. No, you know, no, there's the fanboys that were initially sold on it, but other than that, I don't hear anybody going, I want to go shoot Red. I want to leave my Alexa behind and go shoot with a Red.
No.
Nobody says that. It's not a good sign for the future of that company.
Possibly not. Possibly not.
Unless they come out with their 4K projector that they've been talking about.
The 4K projector is interesting. They've finally announced the 4K player.
Mm-hmm.
And probably Graham has been the driving force to get, but that's an amazing codec to do 4K and the sort of bit rates they're talking about. It's like 4 megabits per second.
Still,
I mean, it was 10 megabits at the demo they did at NAB, 2 years ago?
Mm-hmm.
And they had it down to 10 megabits, and I thought that was incredible. And to get it down even further was really amazing. But without an affordable 4K projector, there isn't a huge market.
Right, there's no point, exactly.
For the 4K player.
I mean, that's the next big saturation. If they can come out with a 4K projector in, I don't know, the $30,000, $40,000 range, all those theaters.
Yes.
You know?
All those theaters that are looking to replace it.
Right.
Huge potential market.
It's a huge potential market that they will never, ever get.
Why?
Because the MPAA will require all the security on the player.
They'll have to put some kind of security in place, yeah.
So basically, if it's not from Sony, it's not going to be sold into a cinema.
Because Sony is so well known for their copyright protections.
Yes.
You remember the DVD? Or the CD? It was a CD, right? Where you could take the black
felt
pen
one
around
the
outside.
That one too.
Sharpie.
That was when they weren't. That was a little too insecure. So then they went the extra distance and put a rootkit on you, and basically made your computer very vulnerable to security penetration. So that was a blunder the other direction.
Okay, so anything else? Any other trends you sense this year?
No, just the downward pressure on the price for software and technology in general. We'd pay less and get more for everything.
Yeah,
in the technology side, and that means that producers tend to try and pay less and get more from the talent.
Yes,
which is not benefiting from Moore's law. I think that's one of the pressures that we're going to see continually in the future.
I agree. We're definitely. Well, it's not just our industry. That's across the board. That's across everything in the country, it seems.
What is going to happen in the next year is the subject of the next show.
Yes.
So for the moment, we've got our large format sensors taking over, affordable cameras. We've got double system audio being much easier to implement without the time code hassles of days gone by, although it still gives you a better result faster. We've got downward pressures on software pricing and all hardware pricing. I think I said that already. Maybe that's the one that gets me most.
Are you concerned about the downward
pressure on software prices?
But, you know, not so much. You can still make money out of a $5 app.
Yeah, and you just have to sell a lot more.
You just have to sell a lot of them.
Yeah.
This is apropos of nothing, but it's interesting that the $5 and $10 customers seem to be a lot more demanding than the $199 and $495 customers are.
Nothing's changed. When I started AlphaDyes, you know, it only took me a few months to figure out that, you know, because you go for any business you can get. It took me just not that long to figure out that the lower the budget the people had, the more work it was going to be.
Yeah.
And I finally figured out why that is. It's because the people who have those lower budgets, that goes through the whole process, which means that they've had the worst crew, you know, et cetera, down the line. So you've got the more to deal with, and they have the least experience because they've been doing it a long time and know what they're doing. They've got higher budgets.
Yeah,
they're in, you know. So it just tends to be the lowest common denominator across the board.
And if you'd like to see what we can do with metadata, check out assisted editing and see the tools that we have for Premiere Pro, Final Cut Pro 7, and Final Cut Pro 10.
And if you have a project and you want to make it sound better and look better, come by to alphadogs.tv. And don't forget to visit editorslounge.com to see what new meetings we have coming up and what great videos, instructional videos we have online. And based on when you hear this, I hope you have a happy and prosperous 2013.
And do something creative in 2013.